From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, medicine hunting in the rainforest. We talk with journalist Christopher Joyce about searching for cures to cancer, AIDS, and other diseases through indigenous plants and folk remedies. The search has brought together shamans, ethnobotanists, and pharmaceutical companies. Also today, Ruthie Bolton was born to a 13-year-old mother. She was raised by an abusive grandfather. She's written a memoir with the help of acclaimed novelist Josephine Humphreys. We'll meet them both. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Tom Hanks' new film, Forrest Gump. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton has ended his trip to Poland today. He spoke to the Polish parliament and assured them their country would be part of a NATO expansion. Mr. Clinton has also promised Poland $200 million in aid to encourage investment and growth. The BBC's Jeremy Harris reports from Warsaw.
Mr. Clinton praised Polish reforms and pledged substantial new American aid to help smooth their progress at a time of mounting political resistance. Mr. Clinton promised that the Iron Curtain would not be replaced by a veil of indifference.
No country should have the right to veto, compromise, or threaten democratic Poland's or any other democracy's integration into Western institutions.
The institution that Poland and its neighbors most want to join is the NATO alliance. Mr. Clinton stressed that NATO expansion was now a question not of whether, but of when and how. He's already called for alliance leaders to meet to consider the next steps. His failure to offer a time frame for adding new members to the alliance will disappoint many here, but surprise few.
Jeremy Harris reporting. Colorado Governor Roy Romer says yesterday's deaths of several firefighters are a reminder of how deadly wildfires can be. A wind-whipped forest fire killed 13 workers yesterday. Firefighters have just found the body of one of two missing men. Romer wants to know why so many firefighters died. Weather forecasters had predicted high winds, but the crews were still left in the field. The Colorado fire has scorched 2,200 acres and is still burning. Strong winds are again a concern. A Los Angeles judge has denied a defense motion to suppress evidence on the O.J. Simpson case. Prosecutors can now use the material found at Simpson's home the morning after his ex-wife and a friend of hers were murdered. NPR's Ina Jaffe reports.
The evidence in question was spotted by police before they obtained a search warrant. It includes spots of blood on O.J. Simpson's driveway, a blood spot on the door of his white Ford Bronco, and a bloody glove that resembles one found at the murder scene. But Judge Kathleen Kennedy Powell ruled that police were justified in entering the Simpson property. She accepted officers' testimony that they went to Simpson's home to inform him of his ex-wife's death. And when there was no answer to the bell or the phone and they found blood on his car, they had reason to believe someone inside might need their help. They didn't enter like stormtroopers, she said, turning over every leaf and opening every closet, but because they reasonably believed there was an emergency. At the Criminal Courts Building in Los Angeles, I'm Ina Jaffe.
U.S. Marines are now shipping out for waters off Haiti. The Pentagon says American forces have already practiced for a possible invasion to oust Haiti's military leaders. A Pentagon spokesman says President Clinton has not ruled out a military option, although no invasion is imminent. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up 13 points at 3,687. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. Tension is building in Nigeria as soldiers began replacing striking oil workers at oil depots around the country. The military-dominated government is trying to break a crippling walkout call to protest the dictatorship. The government of General Sani Abacha says anybody who tries to interfere with the military's effort to revive the country's oil industry will get the death penalty. Fuel pumps are dry in several cities. Oil managers say they'll join the rank-and-file walkout. Many local government workers and nurses have already gone on strike. 17 other industrial unions are threatening to do the same thing. General Abacha has arrested human rights activists, journalists, and former politicians in an attempt to crush dissent. The countdown for tomorrow's space shuttle launch is proceeding smoothly, but Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports the forecast may get in the way.
Officials at the Kennedy Space Center report no technical or mechanical problems so far for the Shuttle Columbia. Workers at the launch pad are busy today loading time-critical experiments aboard the orbiter that will be used during the two-week mission. Columbia and a crew of seven are scheduled for liftoff at 12:43 Eastern Time tomorrow afternoon. Forecasters say there's a 40% chance that rain showers and thunderstorms will cause a delay in the count. This is currently the rainy season in Florida, and the area is commonly drenched by rain nearly every afternoon. Rain or lightning within 30 miles of the launch pad would violate acceptable conditions for a liftoff attempt. When Columbia does lift off, it will mark the first flight into space for a female Japanese astronaut. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
Senate Republicans say health care fraud is costing about $100 billion a year. Maine Senator William Cohen has released a study by GOP members of the Senate Aging Committee. The report says the losses are from scams like double billing, billing for services never rendered, and payments for ghost patients. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. About 25% of our prescription drugs contain an active ingredient derived from a plant. Many of those plants come from the rainforest, and you know what's happening to the rainforests. My guest, Christopher Joyce, is the author of the new book, Earthly Goods, Medicine Hunting in the Rainforest. He says ethnobotanists, cancer researchers, and pharmaceutical companies are part of a new radical experiment. Its goal is to change the way people search for and test potential new medicines, and to preserve the world's great forests by showing how valuable its plants are, both medically and financially. Joyce is an editor and reporter at NPR. As part of his research, he traveled through South American rainforests with ethnobotanists and representatives of pharmaceutical companies. He told me it's a long, involved process, transforming a rainforest plant into a prescription drug.
The process probably takes 10-15 years from start to finish, at least.
Why does it take so long? You know, if you bring back a plant, you know it has a certain healing effect. Why should it take 15 years?
Well, often you don't know it has a healing effect. You're merely bringing back lots and lots of plants. The National Cancer Institute is an example. They're right now embarked on a huge program of vacuuming the rainforest as well as tropical oceans for interesting organisms with interesting compounds. But then you have to, in the past, you take it and you give it to a rat, and if it has an effect on the rat, you then take it from there. Nowadays, we're able to be more specific. We can use the test tube and use that to find out whether, for example, an extract from a plant or an insect does something in the test tube to, say, the AIDS virus. Let's say it does. Well, you've got 50 compounds in there. Which one is the one? It's a very lengthy process to sort of winnow out the other 49 compounds till you find the one that's actually doing the work. After that, you have to test it on various types of AIDS viruses. You also have to then test it for toxicity. That is, well, maybe it'll kill the AIDS virus, but it might also kill the patient. And that takes a long time. And then, of course, it has to go through the government review. And you know, drugs take a long time, and this is one of the reasons why.
There's a new framework for relationships between the pharmaceutical companies and the indigenous people who live in the rainforest. You say the most contentious issue now is about intellectual property rights. How do intellectual property rights apply to plants in the rainforest?
That's a difficult problem, and I don't think anybody has solved it. The political climate nowadays is quite different from when people would go off to the rainforest, botanists for pharmaceutical companies or governments, and simply take what they wanted in exchange for boat motors or machetes or a few shotguns. Nowadays, tropical countries are very wary of the intrusion of northern scientists, and yet there's really no legal framework, certainly not an international legal framework, that will protect third world countries and protect their, their flora and fauna, their genetic resources. There have been some attempts in the Rio Treaty that was just signed by President Clinton after the Rio Summit on the Environment, which has made an attempt to, at least in principle, set down the idea that these resources do belong to the people in the countries where they're found. And yet, really, it's sort of a case-by-case situation. When a drug company or a government decides to go to, say, country like Panama or Ecuador. It's really up to the local people to be able to demand the kind of exchange of money technological transfer in exchange for the biological wealth that they still own.
So what's at issue is whether countries have rights to indigenous plants in the way they, say, have rights to their own natural resources and minerals if an outsider came in and mined them.
That's a good way of looking at it, and a good analogy, I think, is a term that's commonly being used now is chemical prospecting. Chemical prospecting being the idea that you go into a rainforest which is chemically rich, and you mine it. You prospect first, and you find what's valuable. And the beauty in it is that you can do it renewably. You don't have to yank out all the plants. You can find a few of them and try to bring them back and propagate them at home. If you can't do that, you propagate them there. Again, the intellectual property rights question and the political question here is, what do you give and guarantee to the people in that community, the people in that state, the people in that country, especially if that plant also happens to be found, for example, in a country in Asia as well as South America? Who has the right to it? Who owns a work of nature? And it's a very difficult concept that nobody in any country really has pinned down.
There's even the question of royalties now.
Well, royalties is a good way to approach it, and there is a model. There has been a real groundbreaking experiment and agreement between Merck, which is the world's largest pharmaceutical company, and an organization in Costa Rica called INBIO, Instituto Nacional de Biodiversidad, which basically means the National Biodiversity Institute. And what the Costa Ricans have done basically is say to Merck and Company and others who might be interested that, look, we're turning our country, it has tens and tens of thousands of unique plants and unique insects. We're turning it into a nursery, and if you want to get in, you have to pay at the door. And if you find anything, then we'll do some of the upfront work. We'll do some of the extraction. We'll do some of the chemical analysis. You do the medical testing, and if you find something that turns into a drug, you owe us a royalty. This was agreed to in 1992. I believe they signed the agreement. And it's really the first in the world where such an agreement's been signed.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Christopher Joyce. His new book is called Earthly Goods, Medicine Hunting in the Rainforest. There's another group of people that call themselves eco-rationalists that are also looking for plant substances with healing effects in the rainforest. How does their approach differ with the ethnobotanists?
Well, the eco-rationalists, they're self-named, I think. I don't know that the ethnobotanists would agree with this term rationalist. They all work rationally, but for lack of a better term, these are people who dismiss the shamanistic approach. They say, look, we really don't need to spend our time talking with shamans in villages who are the last of actually a dying breed of indigenous people who understand the curing plants of their cultures. Given the fact that we have such powerful technology at home, what we really need to do is just simply look, based on our own botanical knowledge, we know that certain families of plants, let's say Myristicaceae, that's a tropical family of plants, or some other family that in the past has given us a lot of very powerful bioactive compounds. We know that's been good in the past. Let's go collect unusual Myristicaceae. Let's go collect unusual Melastomataceae and bring it back and just put it into the maw of these huge testing operations that now companies have set up. And we can run them through hundreds, if not thousands, of different plants per day. And just look for hits. We don't need to mess around with the kinds of compounds that shamans use, many of which simply have some sort of active effect, but we really don't know what it is, and we're much more interested in specialized single compounds, not a mass of chemicals that comes out of a plant.
Yeah, and these eco-rationalists have criticized the shaman approach to finding plants as being too broad spectrum, you know, that you don't know specifically what the substance on the plant does and what it affects because the plants are used more as a cure-all.
Yes, they're looking, most pharmaceutical companies and medicinal botanists are looking for something very specific. For example, something that cuts down on the buildup of cholesterol or something
A concept that people in the rainforest wouldn't even know.
Certainly not. They know that a certain plant, like a varola, was one that I came across in Ecuador. It happens to be a tree whose bark has been used for centuries as a hallucinogen. It was used in ceremonial practices, and shamans use it to be able to see visions to know how to cure their patients. But the bark is also, as we've found out recently, quite useful at working on fungal infections. And the native peoples there rub it on fungal infections on their arms and legs, and it seems to work quite well. But nobody knows. There's probably 50 or 60 or 70 different phytochemicals, as we call them, plant chemicals, in that bark. Who knows which one actually works and who knows what doesn't? Furthermore, many of the concoctions that shamans put together contain 8 or 9 or 10 different kinds of plants. And even if it works, nobody really knows which part of it works. And you can't give people here in the United States a concoction like that and say, well, cross your fingers and hope it works.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Christopher Joyce, and we're talking about his new book, Earthly Goods, Medicine Hunting in the Rainforest. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Christopher Joyce. We're talking about his new book, Earthly Goods, Medicine Hunting in the Rainforest. You traveled with ethnobotanists through the rainforest in Costa Rica and Ecuador. Did you actually travel with people who were working with shamans in trying out plant substances?
Yes, I did. I traveled in Ecuador with Brad Bennett, who's an ethnobotanist now at Florida International University and also associated with the New York Botanical Garden, which is probably the center for ethnobotany in North America, or United States, certainly. Brad was familiar with several indigenous groups in Ecuador, the Shuar Indians, for example, and the Shuar people, now numbering about 20,000 left in existence, living in the western Amazon. He lived with them for many, many, many months over a two-year period, studying their indigenous, their useful plants, and covering everything from medicines to food to baskets to housing. And I've traveled with him to a couple of places. We went to a place called Hatun Sacha, which is a biological research station in the Amazon, and lived with the Quechua people who lived nearby the biological station and studied their useful plants. They took us through the forest. The way this usually works is you just simply go for a long walk through the forest with a couple of shamans or people who know the healing plants of their culture. And you probably pay them by the day. And they tell you, basically pointing from plant to plant, what they're used for, if they're used for anything at all. Brad would swap information. He might well recognize the family of the plant, give them the Latin name. So there's an exchange of information. Brad Bennett would also always publish his findings in the local language, Spanish there or the Quechua language, and return that information to them. He himself was not working for a drug company. He's simply an academic. But, of course, what he was able to find out may be used someday by people interested in pharmaceuticals, because he did take chemical samples from trees. You also take physical samples, leaves, flowers, bark, and you also take chemical samples, say, from the sap. We also traveled to northwest Ecuador to visit the Chachi people, who number even fewer, very few left of the Chachi, in a very remote area of Ecuador, and studied their healing plants from their shamans.
So when Bennett would give a shaman the Latin name for a plant, would that be of any value at all to the shaman?
Well, they found it to be interesting. Brad Bennett, as many ethnobotanists do, don't just come down for a week or so. He would go back and forth and sometimes spend months and months with these cultures and would exchange information about what he knew about, say, the indigenous plants of other peoples living in various parts of the Amazon. He would bring them documents about tropical botany. He would help them economically wherever he could. He doesn't have a lot of money himself. And because he's a practicing ethnobotanist, he does subscribe to the idea that you try as much as you can to return value. He's, again, not working for a drug company, but, for example, he's with the Chachi Indians, he set up a system for them to be able to sell some of their indigenous art products, baskets and weavings and that sort of thing, in North America to help their local economy in the village where he worked.
Did you participate in any rituals or ceremonies while you were in the rainforest?
I didn't myself. Brad Bennett did quite often. And some of the other people I traveled with when we were visiting the Chachi Indians in northwestern Ecuador did participate. It's not a terribly edifying or enjoyable experience. Sometimes it goes on all night. Many of the shamans drink a lot of rum and some of the ceremonies include smoking a lot of cigarettes and spitting rum on the affected part of the body, ritual acts like sucking stones or sucking demons out of the body. Often the shamans will take hallucinogenic drugs from plants, of course. Ayahuasca is one of them. It comes from a vine that's common in the Western, well, all over the Amazon. It can go on all night and be rather an exhausting affair. What some people misunderstand, though, is that it's not all hocus-pocus because they also use, in these ceremonies, herbal remedies. And some of these herbal remedies actually do work. Again, they're broad spectrum. They may not be very specific, but it's those herbal remedies, not the ceremonial sort of demonstrations that go on around it that ethnobotanists are particularly interested in.
Were you curious to try any of the hallucinogenics?
I was curious about it. At the time, it really wasn't a good thing to do. It's not as if the indigenous peoples that we visited haven't seen Westerners before, and unfortunately they have seen people who come down looking for a sort of a fun trip.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, ethnobotanists really frown on this because it gives them and the people who come with them a bad reputation. These hallucinogenic plants are very, very important, in fact, holy plants for the indigenous people. And most of the time, they don't take them for a lark. They take them during ceremonies at which they communicate with spirits. Their shamans take them because they're privileged members of their society. And for a Westerner to come down and, stick a snuff tube up his nose and snort a bunch of powder, may make good publicity, but I think you'll find a lot of ethnobotanists frown on the practice.
You know what I found interesting? That ethnobotanists now are not only looking for plants, but they're looking for insects, too. What do they hope to find in insects? And I'm wondering, too, if you participated in any insect tracking.
Actually, when I was in, for example, in Costa Rica, we were looking for plants and microorganisms. We would take samples of roots and samples of earth around roots.
Looking what for funguses and...
Right, funguses and microorganisms that might be useful as well.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't look for insects, although it's quite popular in Costa Rica, and it's part of the arrangement that Merck & Company has with the Costa Ricans. Insects certainly have a fantastic armamentarium of chemicals, toxic chemicals that they use to fight off predators, for example, or pheromones that they use. These are hormones or compounds that they use to communicate, basically, or to attract other insects when they're mating. It's a huge panoply of compounds in insects that people really have barely begun to scratch the surface.
So what do the experts in the field think the odds are that there are great drugs that have not been discovered yet within the plants of the rainforest?
If you count all the flowering plants of the world, you come up with about 250,000. And according to some of the botanists, or many of the botanists that I've talked to, probably only 1, 2, 3, maybe even 5% tops have been looked at in a methodical, chemical way. So it's fair to say that there's a vast number out there, over 200,000 different species of plants, that we have no idea what's inside them.
What gives you the most hope that pharmaceutical companies realize the potential for medicinal plants in the rainforest?
One, the fact that several of them and also the U.S. government are spending a few million dollars, not a lot, but a few million, to go back to the rainforest, to hire botanists who otherwise might not have the money to do this, to go back and do inventories and to collect plants. It's begun. That's hopeful. Secondly, already within the past 4 or 5 years since this has been going on, we have now about 4 or 5 or 6 new compounds. I think 3 or 4 of them apparently effective against AIDS in the test tube only, I must emphasize. They're very interesting. One's a vine from Cameroon. Another is a tree from Sarawak in Malaysia. We also have a compound from a seaweed that was found in the Philippines. And, of course, there's this herpes, potential herpes drug from the wound healing agent that was found in Ecuador. So there's several possibilities that could produce drugs over the next few years. And I think even the fact that they're interesting chemically and are in clinical trials and with humans or on the verge of clinical trials, that in itself is promising. And, of course, if one of them breaks through and actually becomes a money-making drug, I think we're on the road to possibly a different way of looking at the rainforest.
The ingredient that you mentioned can work against AIDS. Is it against HIV itself or against opportunistic infections that come with AIDS?
There are a couple of compounds that seem to work against HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. Again, it's only in the test tube, but the National Cancer Institute discovered a plant called Ancistrocladus. It's a vine that grows in the rainforest in Cameroon. From that, they have now isolated a single compound. They call it michelamine, which is named after the wife of the researcher who found it. And it is promising. It has some problem. It's quite toxic. But if they can get the toxicity down so that you don't kill the patient, they are rather enthusiastic about it. And they've got a couple others like that. One of the unfortunate problems, and it reinforces the argument here, is that, for example, the West African plant is very hard to propagate in a nursery. It's taken wild at the moment. They have a nursery growing in Cameroon at a secret location. They're rather worried about a run on this plant. But it's very hard to grow it. So the tree that was found in Malaysia, in Sarawak, they took a random sample of a whole bunch of plants from the area. This one was a hit, seemed to work in the test tube. Went back to collect more of it, and the tree was gone. It had been cut down, and it turned out to be the only individual tree of that species they could find. Now, luckily, they've been able to go back and find related species that seem to have the same chemical compound or a close analog of that compound, not quite as effective. And they're working with that, hoping that they can synthesize this compound eventually based on what they know. But it only served to point out that here today and gone tomorrow is a sad fact of chemical prospecting in the rainforest.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It was my pleasure.
Christopher Joyce is the author of Earthly Goods, Medicine Hunting in the Rainforest. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Ruthie Bolton's grandfather drove away her 13-year-old mother, beat Ruthie's grandmother to death, and then raised Ruthie. Ruthie decided she had to tell her story, but she'd never written anything before. A friend put her in touch with novelist Josephine Humphreys. Coming up, we talk with them about co-writing Ruthie Bolton's new memoir, Gal. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Forrest Gump, the new film starring Tom Hanks. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Panama's president says he is withdrawing his offer to accept Haitian refugees. U.S. officials say they failed to come to agreement with Panama on erecting a safe haven for the Haitian refugees. The disagreement severely undermines the Clinton administration's ability to carry out its new policy on Haitian boat people. The Pentagon now says the Coast Guard intercepted more than 1,500 Haitians on the seas yesterday. That means 14,000 refugees have been picked up since June 16th. That's when President Clinton dropped the policy of automatically returning the refugees to Haiti. A Pentagon official says there are more than 10,000 refugees at the U.S. Naval Base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Another 3,200 Haitians are aboard U.S. ships headed to Guantanamo Bay. PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat and Israeli officials have ended their series of talks in Paris. The discussions were about increased Palestinian self-rule. Leaders say the meeting went very well. They've agreed to resume talks next week in Cairo. Topics include Palestinian elections and the release of more Palestinian prisoners from Israeli jails. Arafat says he'll convene the Palestinian National Council soon to get rid of language from the Palestinian Charter that calls for Israel's destruction. Rightist Israelis have cited the charter to campaign against the peace agreement. Georgia authorities say 16 people have died as a result of heavy flooding. The remnants of Tropical Storm Alberto are stalled over the south, which has been inundated with rain. Relief workers are urging people not to act independently when trying to set up emergency help, but instead to work with relief organizations. Dennis Washington of member station WUAL reports.
Scott Adcock, spokesman for the Alabama Emergency Management Agency, says one of the biggest problems with disasters such as this is the uncoordinated relief shipments from private citizens. He says relief organizations such as the Red Cross are the best way to help.
Random collections and random shipments to a disaster area can be a disaster within a disaster if it's not handled properly, and we're asking that people help us with that.
Due to the fact that the rains continue to fall, Adcock says local governments have not asked for any particular types of donations. He says once the flooding subsides and local officials have a chance to assess the damage, then they will have a better idea of what will be needed. For National Public Radio, I'm Dennis Washington in Tuscaloosa, Alabama.
Analysts say the Federal Reserve apparently is keeping short-term interest rates steady for now. They say the Fed's inaction is a clear signal that the central bank is focused on the American economy, not the sagging dollar. On Wall Street, stocks closed higher today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained nearly 14 points to close at 3,688. Advances led declines by a margin of 3-2 in heavy trading. This is NPR. A Los Angeles judge has ruled that prosecutors can use a bloody glove and bloodstains found at O.J. Simpson's home as evidence in a possible murder trial. Simpson is in the middle of a preliminary hearing. Prosecutors are showing the evidence they've collected to demonstrate why he should be tried in the murders of his ex-wife and another man. The judge's ruling to allow the evidence into the hearing is a blow to the defense, but the evidence can be challenged again if the case moves on to a full trial. Republican Senator Bill Cohen of Maine is calling on fellow lawmakers to include measures for curbing health care fraud in the crime bill, rather than waiting for health reform legislation. NPR's Caroline Clark Kelly reports.
The Senate version of the crime bill contains measures to toughen federal statutes against medical fraud, including overbilling for medical devices and charging for services that were never performed. Some members of the House believe these measures belong in health reform legislation, but Senator Cohen says he doesn't want to take that risk.
I don't know if we'll have a health care bill. I mean, I hope that we have a health care bill, but no one can conclude that we will have one. But in the meantime, it may take until August, September, October, maybe longer. If we're losing $275 million a day, why should we wait for the health care bill? We ought to pass the law now and stop the bleeding.
Cohen says Medicare and Medicaid are especially hard hit by fraud and that medical schemes overall are costing consumers and taxpayers about $100 billion a year. I'm Carol Ann Clark Kelly in Washington.
The southern Yemeni city of Aden has fallen to northern Yemeni troops. The north has declared victory in the two-month-old civil war. Southern separatist leaders have reportedly fled the country. The northern soldiers apparently found no resistance in the southern city, and the only sounds heard by reporters seem to be some muffled explosions from the vicinity of the airport and some small arms fire. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ruthie Bolton was born in 1961 to a 13-year-old mother. Her grandfather drove away the mother, beat Ruthie's grandmother to death, then raised Ruthie. Ruthie is now a 33-year-old mother and wife who says she has the kind of loving family she never knew as a child. She recently tried to write the story of her life, and after close to 60 pages, knew she needed help. The help finally came from acclaimed novelist Josephine Humphreys, who, like Bolton, lives in Charleston, South Carolina. Bolton dictated her story. Humphreys edited it into a book. Ruthie Bolton's new memoir is Gal. Ruthie Bolton is, by the way, a pen name. She wanted to protect the privacy of her relatives. Before we meet her, let's find out how Josephine Humphreys discovered her.
I have an office in downtown Charleston in the old section of the city in the historic area, and there is a janitor in the building that I'd become friends with who stopped me one day in the hall and gave me a telephone number on a little card. And I was struck on the telephone by the pure sound of her voice and really was sort of entranced with it. And so I agreed to actually go over to her house, pick up the manuscript, and said I would get in touch with her.
What was the manuscript like?
It was 58 pages on school paper, and it was bound in a school folder that said Parent Handbook on the outside. And it was a handwritten, really sort of sketch of her life, which I could tell was unusual. But it wasn't a full story. There were no real scenes in it, and it was just it was the skeleton of a story.
So it wasn't the writing itself that impressed you.
No.
What impressed you about her story?
First of all, it was the single-mindedness of the narration. There was a drive behind the telling that I thought was unusual. I could see a real power there. Wanting to speak. And I'm not a writing teacher. I don't really have a lot of contact with people who are trying to write, but of what I have seen, that is a gift, and it's a big help to someone who's starting to write a book. Also, the fact that we are near neighbors interested me, and that her world was so very, very different from mine, and I was interested in that aspect of her manuscript as well. Another world opening up to me.
How does this book figure into your writing? And I'm wondering, for instance, if writing in her voice is going to be helpful to you in your fiction and writing in the voices of characters whose lives are different than your own.
Yeah. Well, I don't know whether it'll be a help. I assume that it will be. I think it will be because it was so exciting to me. I was stuck in the middle of a book I've been writing for a long time, and I live the life of a writer that is pretty solitary existence. And all of a sudden, this wonderful thing happened to me, and I felt during the taping and ever since, I've felt really energized in a lot of different ways. But one is just by the language, the power of her language. And it's not a literary language. It's, to me, is much stronger and realer than the literary language of my own books. So I would assume that it's an energizing force.
Novelist Josephine Humphreys collaborated with Ruthie Bolton on Bolton's new memoir, Gal. We'll talk with Ruthie Bolton after this break. This is Fresh Air. Ruthie Bolton's memoir, Gal, has been praised both for the power of its personal story and as a sociological document. It's a portrait of a life of poverty and family violence. I spoke to Bolton and asked if she knows much about what her mother's life was like at the age of 13 when she gave birth to Ruthie.
I know that she was in the band. She played the drums. And I knew that she was disturbed in many ways from my grandfather that beat her constantly. For what reason, I can't explain it myself. And as time went by, I still didn't really know her that well. Just in and out moments with her.
How much time did you spend with her?
Well, out of my whole time, I could say 4 full days, probably.
Your mother gave away all her children.
Yeah.
Do you know why?
All I ever thought is that she probably couldn't take care of us.
Because she was too young or for other reasons, too?
I thought to myself she didn't want to be bothered with kids. She wanted life out in the streets and just wanted to be free of kids. I honestly don't know why. I don't know.
So you grew up with your grandparents?
Yes.
In South Carolina. Were you treated like one of their children, even though you were their grandchild?
Yeah. And with my grandmother, definitely, yes.
Now, your grandparents had a rough relationship. Your grandfather beat your grandmother.
Yes, definitely.
In fact, he beat her to death.
He beat her so much until I feel in my heart the beatings from him giving her is the cause of her not being here today.
What were those beatings like? Would you hear them?
Yes.
Would you see them?
Yeah, some of them. They were like, you can hear the feet step of the two parties and the slamming against the walls. I also recall a night when she broke the glass and he grabbed it out of her hand and he ran it across her arms and it gave her like 52 stitches. And I remember hearing the door opening. And you can hear somebody scuffling in the house. And he had a water hose around her neck. And I heard a fell. And I snuck up. And I went in the bathroom. And there she was in the tub. And it was terrible. So I thought she was dead at that moment, but she wasn't. She was alive.
How old were you when your grandmother died?
I guess I was about 6 years old.
When your grandfather was bringing you up, he beat the kids.
Yes.
What did he expect you to do for him? What was his attitude about what your place was in the house?
You were to get up in the morning, 6 a.m., cook his breakfast, give him coffee, have his clothes ready, his shoes, his socks. And when he's dressed, you're to comb his hair. And when he leaves, you're to clean the house, buff the floors, wash the clothes with a scrub board in the tub constantly, clean the yard, burn the trash, cut the grass. And when he gets home, you are to have his dinner sitting on the table. The minute he sits to the table, it has to be there, his glasses on the other side, the mail. And when he sits down, you are to be there to take off his shoes and take off his socks, and you just sit and wait for the next call.
You became pregnant and married the man who was the father of your baby a couple of months before you gave birth.
Right.
Did you think that you loved him?
No. I knew I didn't love him, but I was 18 then, and I was pregnant. And how I was raised that if you ever get pregnant by any man, that's the person you're supposed to marry. And I didn't want my family to see me having a baby without the man that whose child it was.
So you became a mother.
Right.
What were your models of what a mother's supposed to be like? Your mother left you. Your grandmother was virtually beaten to death by your grandfather. So who could you turn to say, well, how does a good mother behave? What does a good mother do?
I had nobody to turn to. I took it on myself. Sometimes I would leave the baby in the house and go to the store to get a pack of cigarettes. It didn't bother me because I figured that it was normal. And, I mean, I did take good care of the baby and everything, but there were times I would go to the store. The store was like 5 minutes away from me. I would walk to the store and back. And I remember one time coming home and I left the baby on the bed. But when I went in the room, I didn't see the baby at all. I didn't know where the baby was at. And I was just frightened, and the baby had fell behind the bed. And I said to myself, God, how long has she been back there? So I realized that I cannot do that anymore.
Was the baby okay?
Yeah. She was sleeping. So she could have been screaming her lungs out the time she fell, and I don't know. But that got to me when I saw that.
You decided you wanted to leave your husband. And
yes.
What you did was you called your mother-in-law and
yeah.
said that you were going to leave her son.
Yeah.
You needed to find another apartment and asked right. if you could leave your daughter
yes.
with her in the interim.
Right.
And she ended up keeping your daughter.
Yeah, I asked her, could she keep her for me? The reason why I left this man, because he beat me. And I said to myself, there's no way I'm going to get beat again by nobody, no other man. And he said that he was sorry, but I just could not accept that because it was more than once. And I called his mother and I asked her, could she keep my baby for me until I get up on my feet? She said, yes, bring the baby over. So I did. When I got up on my feet, it was a totally different story.
She wouldn't give her back.
She wouldn't even let me come and see her. I went crazy. I just went berserk. So I began to drink a lot. I began to smoke a lot of marijuana. I just went crazy.
You left your husband, the father of your daughter.
Right.
You eventually remarried.
Yeah.
And the person you married came from such a different family than you did.
Completely.
So when you went to visit his family in Florida, I mean, they welcomed you, they'd hug you and kiss you and do things for you, and it sounds like it made you awfully uncomfortable.
Sad to say it did.
What was so hard to accept about that? It sounded like you really disliked them for a while for treating you that way.
Yeah, I did. Because I thought it wasn't real.
That they must be phonies? Because people aren't like that?
Right. Day one, when I first met them, they grabbed me and they kissed me and they hugged me, and it was going on and it kept going on. And I asked Ray, why was his family like that? And he said, Ruthie, that's the way my family always was. And then it began to come into his cousins and nieces and aunts. And it was the same thing. And I just wondered, why are these people kissing me, hugging me, touching me, saying they love me? It just didn't seem real. I was scared because I found out as they kept doing it, that's what I always wanted as a kid. And all of a sudden, it really became to life, and I couldn't accept it. And I didn't know how to accept it. I said, if I ever have any more kids, I will love them and greet them like the family did to me when I first came down.
How many children do you have now?
Five. And they they tell you every day, I love you, I love you, I love you. It's like the family that I wanted as a kid. So I'm giving them what I wanted, not wait until they're an adult to receive that. I made sure that it happened from day one with them.
Ruthie Bolton's new memoir is called Gal. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's new in the O.J. Simpson case?
Well, today the judge ruled on the defense motion to suppress all the evidence that was found at O.J. Simpson's estate. She said that evidence may be presented in this preliminary hearing in which the prosecution is claiming to show that it has enough evidence to bring O.J. Simpson to trial. That ruling came earlier today. We'll be hearing about it on the program. Also, news of the fires in Colorado, the floods in Georgia, a police corruption report released in New York City, and the latest turns in U.S. policy toward Haiti.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Robert Zemeckis is not a household name like Steven Spielberg or George Lucas, but at the box office, he's one of the most successful filmmakers alive. He's directed such hits as Who Framed Roger Rabbit, Romancing the Stone, and the Back to the Future movies, along with 1992's less lucrative Death Becomes Her. His new movie stars Tom Hanks. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of Forrest Gump.
This is going to be a very big movie. One of the three or four biggest of the year. Audiences are going to love it, and more, they're going to cherish it. Dote on it the way book readers have doted on The Bridges of Madison County or Jonathan Livingston Seagull. I can see why. Forrest Gump isn't dopey or fatuous. It has real magic, but it's also, I think, hollow at the core. The year is 1981, and Tom Hanks is Forrest, who sits on a park bench in Savannah, Georgia, wearing one of his endless supply of blue-checked shirts and telling his life story to anyone who'll listen. He's a cheery soul with an IQ of 75, but he seems to have spent the 50s, 60s, and 70s rubbing shoulders with the greatest figures on the American cultural stage. We see the young Elvis Presley pick up Forrest's wobbly-legged dancing and turn it into the swivel hips that wow a nation. Forrest's ping-pong skills help open the door to American diplomacy with China, and he always seems to be at the right place at the right time. At the Watergate Hotel, for instance, when he spots a mysterious burglary across the way. Through Zemeckis' remarkable special effects, Forrest appears at the White House with JFK and LBJ and Nixon, but what drives him always is his love for the beauty who was his childhood companion, Jenny, played by Robin Wright. As he trips blithely through Vietnam and the anti-war movement and the coke-snorting 70s, poor Jenny sinks deeper and deeper into degradation, and after a whirlwind first half, the movie sinks with her. It grows sodden and aimless. Forrest does whimsical things like jogging back and forth across the country for 3 years. Meanwhile, Zemeckis cross-cuts to Jenny shooting dope and getting beaten up by unworthy boyfriends. The message is clear. She'd be a whole lot happier if she stuck with this simple dork who really cares for her. Forrest couldn't agree more.
Will you marry me? I'd make a good husband, Jenny.
You would, Forrest.
But you won't marry me.
You don't want to marry me.
Why don't you love me, Jenny? I'm not a smart man, but I know what love is.
What will make this movie a hit isn't merely its considerable charm and the great formal beauty that Zemeckis has put into directing it. At heart, this is a soothing placebo of a movie. It reassures you that, in a world as messy and ugly and frightening as the one Zemeckis capably pictures in the background, you don't need to understand what's going on. You don't need to be smart or glamorous or have opinions or knowledge or power. Just be decent. Love and riches will follow. In its way, Forrest Gump is as transparent and condescending a fantasy as Regarding Henry, the picture in which Harrison Ford became a better person through the miracle of brain damage. But fortunately, Zemeckis and screenwriter Eric Roth are a lot wittier and more subtle than that. And so is Tom Hanks. The gift for physical comedy that Hanks unveiled in Big reaches a peak in Forrest Gump, and his peculiar accent, half cornpone, half playpen, is one of the most novel and endearing sounds since Marlon Brando invented The Godfather. Forrest Gump may not be as good as it occasionally feels, but Hanks's performance is the real thing.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Technical direction from Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Roberta Schirach directs the show. I'm Jerry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, a travel show that may encourage you to stay home this summer, we talk with intrepid travel writers about the lure, danger, thrills, and discomforts of adventure. We'll feature interviews with Paul Theroux, Thurston Clark, Tracy Johnston, and the late Bruce Chatwin. I'm Terry Gross here in an air-conditioned studio. Join us for the next Fresh Air.